IVM. Welcome to All Things Policy, a daily podcast by the Takshashila Institution. We are a bunch of policy nerds based in Bengaluru, and we like bringing fresh perspectives to Indian affairs and Indian perspectives to global affairs. So grab a cup of coffee, sit back, and join us for today's chat.
Hello and welcome to All Things Policy. I am Amira Rao, and in today's episode, we'll be discussing the United States as a sea power and the impact it has on the world. So the US came out with a maritime strategy document in December of 2020, which laid out the vision for the US as sea power for the decades ahead. To discuss the various contours and caveats of this strategic publication, I am joined by my colleague Aditya Parikh, who has studied the document in detail and has connected some dots that might help us better understand why the US acts the way it does. So with no further introduction, welcome Aditya.
Thank you, Amira. It's great to be back on the show.
So to begin this episode, my first question to you is, what purpose does this strategic publication serve exactly? Could you tell everyone a little bit about it?
So to begin with, let me say that empirically, post-World War II, the United States has striven for a world order that ensures its maritime primacy and place in the world, so to say, as the one true hegemonic power. So some would argue that the U.S. is the successor of a Western tradition of great sea power democracies, which base their primacy in the international order on naval power, perhaps going as far back as to the Athenians. However, the United States, like all maritime powers before it, not only has proliferated its material capability at sea, but also its personnel and an intellectual tradition to carry it forward. As you mentioned, in December 2020, this document composed by the U.S. Naval Service, which is a term that is used for the U.S. Navy, the U.S. Marine Corps, and the Coast Guard. So they collectively like to refer to themselves as the U.S. Naval Service. So they came out with this document, which is titled Advantage at Sea. So it's a strategic publication, which is the latest one in a series of many that they periodically come out with to lay out the strategic vision of their forces. Now, to answer your question, in my opinion, and what I can discern from the document and the discourse around it in the intellectual spheres, the document, it's, as I said, one in a series of many U.S. government functionaries. They're sending out to the same message, but different versions, which are suited to their purpose. So it's a version of the naval services strategic goals, which echo the very same ones that the DoD has, that the presidential administration has. So it's an echo, but very much compartmentalized and very much specialized for the naval services lexicon setting. So, you know, all strategic publications at some level are about dictating the rules of the road as they see for the international order. So this amounts to lexicon setting, focus setting, and perhaps highlighting areas that might not have receive the due recognition in other documents. So, for example, the text of this document opens with a concern over a subject which is very dear to my heart, submarine cables and international trade that depends on them. Because everything is digitized now, so almost $10 trillion worth of financial transactions are going through these cables every day, and the Western countries perceive a threat to these cables and by extension, the international trade that is affected by them. So it really has a great structure to its drafting, the document. So for example, the problem statement section. I mean, I really like the fact that it's not very unlike what folks in other professions, not just the military academia, like say us researchers or software developers, natural scientists, engineers of various kinds, that they would deal with similar problem statements. So, however, since this is about grand strategy and international affairs, more specifically military. The document really boils down to the US's perceived threat from adversaries, and chief among them, Russia and China. No surprise there. So the problem statement really singles them out as adversaries of note, but not to North Korea or Iran, which kind of surprises me. One reason that I could perceive from the text was that these are of secondary concern because of the kind of balance of forces at sea on their side. They are no more than regional threats to the US Naval Service. Well, of course, excluding the nuclear capabilities that one feels and one might feel soon enough.
Okay, so thank you for those interesting points. So now I'd like to ask you, what priorities essentially does this document highlight for the US defense and security apparatus at sea? So what does this mean for them?
So for the priorities, I think it's the clear demarcation of what are the security environment priorities, which is unsurprisingly, as I previously alluded to, international trade, both seaborne and the digital trade, which is facilitated by maritime factors such as undersea cables. So the competition in terms of balance of forces, which I've also alluded to before, recently it made headlines that numerically the PLAN, the PLA Navy, is the largest navy in the world now. And due to their increased emphasis on blue water and expeditionary capability, I think it's worth expanding a bit from the scope of the document itself and into the discourse that goes on around the subject in our academia about the great power competition because of China's rise. So the Chinese are fielding platforms for venturing out and projecting influence and power as far as the polar regions. So there's a bunch of speculation that the polar regions will be the new frontier for a multilateral geopolitical competition where the Canadians, the Chinese, and the traditional Cold War foes, Russia and the US, would be vying for influence and security of the transshipment route. So this also applies to the Northwest Passage, which is very close to the Canadian littoral space, and the Northern Sea Route, or the Northeast Passage, which is close to Russian littoral space. So the document, in my opinion, talks about what kind of apparatus that the US Navy and the other two naval services would need to actually be relevant in this new great power competition.
So you mentioned that the chief adversaries or the chief adversaries of threat to the US are China and Russia. So according to you, what projections does this document make for these adversaries?
So I think the document acknowledges that China has the industrial base, the shipyard base to compete with the US at sea in terms of both numbers, tonnage, and perhaps going forward in terms of technology. So the document also talks about this concept of Russia and China engaging in some sort of a blitzkrieg strategy that they'll quickly seize territory in zones of contention, say, in Russia's case, say, Ukraine or the Baltics, and in China's case, say, Taiwan, and they might present the US with a fait accompli situation, which would be disastrous for US credibility in the world. And the concepts of the US's free and open international order, so to say.
So does this document talk about any specific challenges the US naval services have to conquer in order to maintain their edge against adversaries?
I'm glad that you asked that. And I think it's mostly the same kind of talking points that the US Naval Service and larger DoD establishment has wrestled with since the rise of China became a concern around 2008. However, let me bring your attention to the fact that the US has chosen to re-embrace some lexicon from the UK, which is its predecessor as a great maritime power, which it intentionally broke from in terms of intellectual lexicon on naval matters. So the Americans started using anti-access, area denial, instead of sea control and sea denial at one point. So now they're back to using C control in this context. And let me quote to one of the subheads in the document. They're back to calling it contested Cs require a renewed emphasis on C control. So this is something notable for me because, you know, whenever you look at strategic documents, it's just as much about to communicating to your leader, communicating to your own ranks and your establishment, as well as the adversary that, hey, this is how we would like this discourse to play out. These are our priorities. So when they are talking about C control, this might be an amateur observation, but it is my observation that this is a signal to the UK as well that, hey, your contribution to NATO and its intellectual sphere is appreciated and we would really like you to play a major role against both Russia and China. So I think US embracing C control means a lot in this context.
So does the document talk about the order of battle, so to say, for the US's maritime forces?
Well, not exactly, but it does mention the need for, and I quote, integrated all-domain naval forces. So the emphasis is again on the strategic level, that is jointmanship. So jointmanship is something that is very exemplary in the US nowadays. I mean, it has come a long way since World War II when there was open conflict between the branches of the US military and there was a whole lot of show. There was a lot of sparks flying post-war. The US Marine Corps even had to fight for its survival as a separate branch of the military. So the sea service coming together is in and of itself a great thing for a strategic publication and the vision that it rolls out. So on a tactical level, I think it's about to embracing newer emerging war fighting domains and integrating both through sister services in the naval service and the larger US military, which also has the Space Force now, and allied militaries and their branches. So their infrastructure would also figure a lot in the US's world security picture. So in pursuit of these shared security interests, I think the US is strategically trying to signal to its allies that, hey, you figure a lot in our strategic discourse and that is how we're going to plan for war, if and when it comes. So this, in my opinion, applies equally to the Pacific, where you have the Republic of Korea, South Korea and Japan, the Philippines and Guam for the Pacific Deterrence Initiative, on which we've also done an episode. So I highly recommend that our listeners check that out. So in the European theater, the Baltics and other European allies in NATO would be the cornerstone, as they've always been, in deterring Russia. So I think the talk about jointmanship is the most important factor in this document.
I'm sure that our listeners listening to this episode right now will be more curious to know about this. So are there any related resources you can recommend for our listeners so that they can, you know, dig a little deeper into US Naval Service community strategic thinking and tactics?
I'm glad that you asked that. You know, any research starts with a good literature review. So I've come across a few intellectuals in the US's strategic sphere. Some of them are retired professionals and some of them are, to be quite honest, legends. So, for example, you have Captain Dr. Henry J. Hendricks. He also goes by Jerry Hendricks. His latest book, To Provide and Maintain a Navy. I'm in the process of reviewing it right now. It's been out for about a few months now. Came out in January 2021, I think. So it's probably the best look you would find into the US Navy's intellectual sphere. Captain Hendricks used to be the director of the US Navy's Heritage and History Command. So he really is the person who is supposed to write a polemic, who's supposed to write a strategy document on his own. So he's quintessentially the person you should be listening to if you want to see how the US Navy sees itself and its adversaries and allies. So I highly recommend this book, To Provide and Maintain a Navy. It's just about 280 pages or so. So our listeners should check that out. And for the legend that I was talking about, Captain Wayne P. Hughes, his book, fleet tactics and coastal combat used to be a classic that everybody would read. Every chief of naval staff across the world would have on his recommended reading list. So the third edition of this book, Fleet Tactics and Naval Operations, talks a lot about the new way of war at sea. So I think if you want a crash course, so to say, in how the way of naval warfare has evolved over the centuries, you should really check this out. And obviously, the US being part of this Western tradition of maritime powers basing their primacy on their naval power. So I think Captain Wayne P. Hughes is the way to go if you want to read into that history. It's about, I think, 400, 500 pages or so of absolutely jam-packed history of naval warfare and how it evolved, really, and how naval warfare would be taking place in the future. I'd also obviously like to recommend the text of this document itself, Advantage at Sea, and we'll link it in the description along with the books that we've mentioned. And there are also other U.S. Naval Institute and Congressional Research Service documents which do projections, net assessments, strategic assessments of U.S. adversaries and U.S.'s own forces. So those are worth mentioning, but also link them. So on a lighter note, if you also want to chuckle on how far doomsaying and skepticism on U.S. Military capabilities and credibility go in a fictional scenario, you can also check out this novel called 2034, a novel of the next world war by Elliot Ackerman and Admiral James Stavridis. So that's really a book that will give you a light-hearted but, you know, quite doom and gloom version of how certain intellectuals in the U.S. strategic sphere see any future conflict unfolding. So those are the ones.
Wow. I'm sure our listeners would find these books interesting and engaging. So guys, please look into Aditya's recommendations. I would surely rely on them. On that note, thanks Aditya for this lively chat around US naval strategy and for your comprehensive answers. Given the US's role in the Quad and the security picture of the Indo-Pacific, we will surely revisit this topic and talk about future strategic documents coming out of the US. And on that note, we'll wrap it up. Thanks for listening, folks. Do tune in for more episodes of All Things Policy. Thank you, Aditya.
Thank you, Meera.
The Takshashila Institution is an independent, non-partisan think tank and a school of public policy. We have education programs lasting one semester and 1 year that are tailored specifically for people like you. They are all online and you can take them from anywhere. Admissions are now open for our 12-week graduate certificate program in public policy, defense and foreign affairs, technology policy, and health and life sciences. Visit takshashila.org.in/courses to find out more.
If you liked our show, don't forget to check out other interesting podcasts on the IVM network. You can tune into them on the IVM Podcast app, ivmpodcast.com, or wherever you listen to your podcasts. You can also follow IVM on social media. The handle is @IVMPodcasts on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. And hey, if you'd like to dive into Takshashila's research on technology, strategy, and economic affairs, check us out at our Twitter handle @TakshashilaInst or our website takshashila.org.in.
Hey, it's been another great week on the IVM Podcast Network. On All Things Policy, Ananya Desai and Rohan Pai discuss recurrent bans on fireworks during festive seasons in India and discuss possible solutions to tackle India's air pollution problem. On the Habit Coach podcast, Ashton Doctor welcomes Sahil Mehta, an esteemed mountaineer and author of the book Break Free. Sahil shares a transformative experience which became the catalyst for embracing discipline and fulfillment. The episode explores the profound impact of vulnerability on personal growth. Folks, if you like our shows, do spread the word. Tell your friends and don't forget to rate and review them wherever you're listening to them. Follow us on social media. We are IVM Podcasts on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, and LinkedIn. You'll also find all our shows on YouTube at youtube.com/IVM Podcasts. And finally, we would like to thank our sponsors this week, Omidyar Network India, Abbott, IDFC First Bank, and Save Life Foundation. Thank you for making this possible.